Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me today is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn. Hi, Mom.
Hello, everyone. Hi.
So, this week we've been reading a book that's a real page-turner, wouldn't you say?
Oh, I would say so, yes. I certainly would.
Yes, and a little scary, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, excuse me. Our author of the book, Under My Skin, is Lisa Ungert, and she is a New York Times and international best-selling award-winning author. Her books are published in 26 languages worldwide, have sold millions of copies, and have been named Best of the Year or Top Picks by The Today Show, Good Morning America, Entertainment Weekly, and The Sun Sentinel, among others. Her essays have appeared in The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, NPR, and Travel and Leisure magazine, and Lisa lives in the Tampa Bay area of Florida with her husband, daughter, and labradoodle. And this book is, like Monica said, it's a page turner, that's for sure.
And it gets under your skin.
Yes, it does. That's right.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, Lisa.
Thank you for having me.
So how did you, well, first of all, let's talk a little bit more about the genre. It's suspense, thriller, murder mystery.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all those things, I guess. I mean, that's sort of always like the big question, right? Like what is a thriller? What's a mystery? What's crime fiction? I guess like, you know, sort of when you sit down to write, you're not really asking yourself those questions. But I'm just sort of following the voices in my head. And then, you know, usually my imagination is pretty dark. A little twisted sometimes. So most often what evolves is a crime fiction novel, but you know, there's always a question of what to call it or how you might categorize it. But for me, it's just, you know, the story of the people that happen to be living in my head at the time.
When you start to write a mystery, do you know the ending when you start?
No, definitely not.
The
way things sort of work for me is, you know, usually there's like a germ, like something that ignites my imagination and generally leads me to sort of a swath of research, right? So in the case of Under My Skin, there were a few points that I was obsessed about at the time, but mainly it was a Jungian idea. And Carl Jung said, between the dreams of day and night, there is not so great a difference. And, you know, like as with most Jungian phrases or terms of phrase, you know, it sounds very simple, but when you start to unpack it, there's a lot of layers there. So between the dreams of day and night, I thought, what does he mean by that? Like, you know, and I know that dreams were a very big part of his work as a psychoanalyst. So I started researching sleep and dreams, and I discovered that we spend about 229,000 hours of our lives asleep. That's more than a third of our lives sleeping and dreaming. And yet, you know, we're convinced that what we're experiencing in the real world or in the waking world is more real than what we're experiencing in our dream life. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of had me thinking about, you know, liminal states and like sort of the doorway between waking and sleeping and all the stuff. And so that's when I started hearing the voice of Poppy Lang, who is the protagonist of Under My Skin. So I heard her voice, and it's her voice, or in the case of other books, other voices, maybe one, maybe multiple voices, and I follow those voices through the narrative. So that's kind of the long answer. Like, no, I have no idea how a book is going to end. Well, I don't even know day to day who's going to show up or what they're going to do. And, you know, I kind of feel like I write for the same reason that I read, because I want to know what's going to happen.
So in the case of Under My Skin with Poppy, did you even know when you started that her husband had been murdered? I don't think that's much of a giveaway.
That comes
out pretty early in the book.
Yeah, I knew that she was in a state of terrible grief. You know, I knew that she was in a very bad place. You know, she's a year past the unsolved murder of her husband, and she's sort of white knuckling her way toward, you know, what she keeps calling like a new normal. But, you know, there's no closure, and, you know, she's in therapy, or she's back to work. She seems to be doing everything right, but she's, you know, she's messing with the dosage on her sleep medication. She's taking her pills with alcohol. She's also just taking that, pills from that mystery vial that her best friend Layla gives her. And, you know, so she's in this kind of really bad place. And that's mainly what I knew about her. I did know that she was in grief, that she'd lost her husband. But I also knew that she was sort of, you know, in a state of grief and trauma, which is, you know, it's an altered state, really. I mean, it's where your perception of reality is intensely skewed. And addiction is another one of those states. So that's what I knew about her. I knew that her life was kind of, and her perspective on her life was kind of a kaleidoscope. And I was going to have to sort of figure out what was real and what wasn't real.
Now,
yeah, well, that's it.
I know, it's a heck of a way to write a book, right?
Well, I'll tell you, it's something else because, there's difficulty. I mean, that's the beauty of this book. You're in there with her. And,
yeah,
you know.
Yep.
That's how I want people to feel.
Yeah, Poppy has a lot of confusion about, she's not sure what's real, what's memories, what's dreams, her dreams at night. She's not sure if there's memories involved in those
right. Dreams.
She has kind of daytime dreaming.
Tell
us a little bit more about that and how, you know, what kind of research you had to do to make that something that's true to life.
Yeah. So, at first there was like sort of, I was talking about, you know, this Jungian idea, but there were a couple of other layers of interest for me. So I had, a long conversation with a friend of mine who's a former Navy SEAL, and he now works with soldiers who've come back from combat with PTSD. And we spent some time talking about how soldiers come back, and if their PTSD is not, you know, diagnosed and treated, you know, there's this kind of spiral that they sort of slip into where, you know, you maybe the first thing to go is like sleep, you know, sleep is disrupted. So, you know, sleep interruption is, you know, a place where reality is altered. And then maybe there's some type of self-medication, you know, addiction. And then, because of the resulting emotional instability, then perhaps the family system starts to unravel. You know, the people that you rely on for support start distancing themselves because they're afraid. And how quickly you can devolve into a state of, you know, not knowing what's real and what isn't real. And how quickly our perceptions can be altered. So that was one sort of layer of research. And, you know, sort of throughout my career and throughout the 16 novels I've written, I've spent a lot of time with my characters, many of them who are, you know, damaged in some way or addicted or mentally ill. So I've done a tremendous amount of research over the course of, you know, more than a decade into these, you know, sort of states of awareness or states of perception. So another area that kind of was on my mind at the time was just, you know, addiction and sort of, you know, blackouts and fugue states, which I've written about before. And, I had this conversation with a clinical psychiatrist, and we were talking about, you know, I was trying to understand the nature of, you know, really blackouts. And I was like, well, are these states where you're repressing what's happened to you? Like when you wake up and you can't remember, is it something that you've experienced and then repressed? And he said that no, in fact, it's a failure of cognition, that at a certain point in inebriation or, you know, intoxication, your brain just kind of stops taking in information altogether, which makes perfect sense, but which I found very fascinating, you know, just the idea that the brain you know, just like, nope, that's it. Nothing else coming in.
Now, if that's the case, is it possible to recover memories from that time?
You know, I don't think, and this is the other thing. It's like, I don't think anybody has those answers. I mean, we know more about space than we do about our own brains. And, you know, like, we're only kind of sure about how 3% of it might function. And the rest of it is just kind of this big mystery. So for me, like, you know, the human psyche and the brain, you know, that is like a place of intense curiosity for me. And probably most of my books you might consider to be, you know, the asking and, you know, positing, the asking of questions and like sort of hypothesizing answers as to what might be true. But it may be, you know, in some cases memories are recovered and in some cases not.
And then if you do recover a memory, how do you know for sure that it's a real memory?
I don't know. How do you know for sure that any of your memories are real?
That's true.
That's the other thing.
That's true.
Yeah. I know memory is so slippery. You know, even perception itself is so slippery. Like, if you think about the way even, you know, what you think you see in front of your eyes, right? Like, you're not actually really seeing anything. Your eye is a lens, and light travels through the optic nerve to send signals to your brain. And then your brain is interpreting those signals. So what seems like very real right in front of you might actually not be real at all. Or it might look entirely different than you believe it.
Well, that reminds me.
We're going to go right down the rabbit hole here, girls.
Right. I mean, that, like that internet, there were those things going around the internet, the blue or the gold dress, and there was another one like that, too. I can't remember what the other one was. But you could, I mean, you look at it and you swear. It's like, how could anybody see this as blue? And the people seeing it as blue is like, well, how can anybody see this as gold? And
Yeah. I know. Isn't it crazy? So these are the things that, you know, like when you think about like, oh, the eyewitness testimony, like in law, there's nothing more unreliable than an eyewitness testimony.
And there are many, many people spending life in prison, sometimes even having been executed based on eyewitness testimony could be completely false.
Yeah. I mean, so these are the things that drive me, you know, crazy.
Yeah.
That's why I have to write. I have to, like, come up with all these scenarios to try to figure out how some of the stuff is
And then
working.
Sometimes the person, the accused, too, they don't even know if they did it or didn't do it. They don't know. Because, you know, like Poppy, she doesn't know what she did during that time.
Right. She doesn't know what she did. And... she, you know, and even in the recovery of those memories, you have to wonder, you know, how much of it can she actually depend upon? And even, you know, there's the memories that she has of Jack, of her husband, you know, like it's colored by like sort of the patina of her grief. And it's only like as the book evolves that we get a truer and truer picture of what her marriage was to him. And even in her journey, you know, where she's trying to, you know, she's trying to understand who he was and who they were to each other, and she's not able to rely on herself. So she's asking other people, his best friend, his mother, you know, who was he in these last days? And so, I mean, I think that that's true of a lot of our, you know, a lot of our relationships and a lot of, you know, our ideas about the people in our lives.
Right, and no matter how well you think you know somebody, you never know what's going on inside their head, really.
You don't. You really don't.
One of the things that you described that I can really identify with is when something really shocking happens and when you go to sleep for a while after it happens, you go to sleep at night, and when you first wake up in the morning, you don't remember that happened.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then it hits you all of a sudden, and it's like the grief starts all over again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a, you know, you have the, you know, like, I forget what that, where I heard this, but, you know, it was like you sleep is like, you know, the only like natural state of human bliss, right? The only place where you're, completely free from yourself. At least, you know, your consciousness of yourself, you know, and so it's always like in those moments where, you know, when something horrible has happened and, you know, you kind of, your brain just kind of like powers down and allows you to sleep, you know, those few seconds after you wake up, there's like sort of, you know, it's a liminal state,
right?
It's a doorway.
Right.
It's like between, you know, sleeping and wakefulness. And so you have these like sort of these kind of blank moments where, you know, you could be anyone, you could be anywhere.
And then, of course, you have the difficulty with drugs or alcohol. And then that
once everything kind of goes haywire. I mean, obviously that's the, you know, an altered state in its, I guess, purest definition.
Right. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Lisa Unger, author of Under My Skin. One of the questions I had for you, Lisa, was how did you get into writing thrillers or crime fiction? How did this all start for you?
Well, you know, I don't feel like I chose to write crime fiction any more than I chose to write in the first place. You know, I don't remember a time in my life before I defined myself as a writer. I've been writing since I was a kid, and I've always had this really kind of dark and twisted imagination. You know, I've always just been really fascinated by, you know, sort of the dark side of things. You know, I always kind of liken myself to, you know, like you go to the movies and, you know, it's like a haunted house or something, and there's like the noise in the basement, and then there's the girl in the movie who's like going down the stairs, and everybody in the theater is yelling, "Don't go down the stairs, just get out of the house." But that's me. I'm the girl going down the stairs. I just want to know. And so I always kind of think of myself that way, or like as a, you know, a spelunker. You know, I'm kind of shimmying myself into like sort of the dark places of the human psyche. And so I think that, you know, just kind of naturally it evolved that I would become that kind of writer. You know, before I was a writer, you know, my mom is a librarian. My parents are both avid readers. And, you know, everywhere we lived, we had these like giant bookshelves, you know, filled with my parents' books. And, you know, basically there was zero censorship, you know. So if I could read it, if I could reach it, I could read it, whatever it was.
Uh-oh.
And so I just read and read and read. And, you know, so it was everything from, everything from like Wuthering Heights to, you know, Lady Chatterley's Lover to, you know, Pet Cemetery and Cujo to Flowers in the Attic to Emma to, you know, whatever nonfiction books I found interesting from my dad's side of the bookshelves or whatever. So I was just like this literary omnivore. And then, you know, I discovered pretty early on the short stories of Truman Capote. And I think that that was like the first place where I sort of fell in love with language. Mm-hmm. And then later at an inappropriately early age, I read In Cold Blood, mm-hmm. Which was Truman Capote's true crime book. Probably the first true crime book, I would think.
Right.
And, you know, in reading that, it kind of, in a weird way, gave me permission to be who I was as a writer, you know, like somebody who can write about crime and, you know, sort of the darker side of human nature. But
you seem like such a nice person.
I am. I hear that a lot. I hear that a lot. It's like writing for me is like a daily exorcism, I guess. I get all my questions and like demons out onto the page. But I think, you know, I think part of it too is that, like, you know, I feel like you have to look at what scares you. You know, monsters live in the dark. And there's a big part of me that feels like if you can shine the light on things and you can understand it better, and when you understand something better, it's not as frightening. Mm-hmm. And so I think that a lot of writers who write crime fiction have turned to it at some point to metabolize fear. And I think that, you know, probably a lot of readers turn to crime fiction for the same reason.
Well, years and years ago, I had written a short story that was pretty dark, and I showed it to a new boyfriend, and it so freaked him out that he wasn't even sure he wanted to be with me.
Yeah. It's a good thing my husband's a little tougher than that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think it's okay to explore the dark side. I mean, yeah. It's, Jung calls it the shadow, right? I mean, you know, there is no light without dark. Yeah. And, you know, you can't deny the existence of the shadow. You can't pretend it's not there, because it is.
Now, books, crime fiction books or mysteries, suspense thrillers with female protagonists are sort of having a day, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think they've been having a day for a long time, right? I mean,
yeah. Okay, they're having a decade or maybe a century.
Yeah, it's a particular moment, I think, right now that's kind of interesting. But, you know, I feel like I've, you know, for a very long time, I've been writing, you know, thrillers about, you know, the female protagonists and all various circumstances and reliable and otherwise. So I think that, you know, and a lot of the, you know, female writers who, you know, with whom I'm friends and colleagues, you know, they even longer than I have been writing, you know, sort of very female centric, like strong female character driven thrillers and crime fiction novels. Lisa Gardner, you know, Lisa Scottolini, Tess Gerritsen, Karen Slaughter, you know, we've all been doing this for quite some time.
Now, there have been some really very popular books and HBO series in recent years that are of this genre. Have any of your books been made into movies?
Not yet. Do you know anyone? Can you make some phone calls? No, over the years I've had a number of options, but, you know, that just means that, you know, certain places have the right to potentially make your work into film or television. And so far, you know, none of that has ever sort of blossomed into, you know, television or film. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I feel like it's sort of like a whole other universe.
Yes.
You know, like, publishing is what it is, and I'm a writer, and, you know, I'm happy to be published, and the whole film television thing, you know, I feel like it could happen tomorrow, it could happen 5 years from now, it might never happen, you know, so it's all this kind of, you know, it's all sort of vapory, so I'm always, like, sort of interested to see if something, you know, will find its way onto the screen, but, you know, what sort of drives me day-to-day is the writing.
Well, writing is a very solitary act, really, and the resulting book, you know, you have input from editors, and sometimes that can be significant, but it's still your vision primarily that gets
right
on the page. And with TV and movies, it's so collaborative, and
yeah,
it's really a very different art form.
Yeah, it is truly, you know, very different. And I've never personally, you know, had like the same burning desire to write a screenplay as I have, you know, to write my novels. Like, it's, you know, like, I feel like I kind of live and breathe what I'm working on. And, you know, once I'm in that space, you know, it's like it occupies this really big space in my imagination, and I can't wait to get to the page, you know, day to day, to like sort of explore this, universe that I'm creating, but I've never, you know, had a similar drive to create a screenplay. You know, like it's not, you know, I feel like in some sense I need too many words. Yeah. Yeah, I need like 110,000 words. I can't do it I don't know if I could do it in 90 pages. It seems like a very different, you know, it's like as if I were all of a sudden to decide I wanted to be a poet, you know. That's, you know, I feel like screenwriting is more like poetry. You know, you have to be so spare in your word choice and so precise. And, you know, you really have to have that sort of visual gift. Like, I see this, like, as it would be on the screen. So, I mean, I'm not saying that, like, I won't ever do it or I won't ever have that, you know, that vibe to do it. But so far, like, my voice has been, you know, as long as I can remember, has been the novel.
How long did it take you to write this particular book? Do you remember?
A first draft generally takes between 9 and 12 months.
And
so, yeah, and then there'll be another year of editing. And
while that's happening, are you starting on the next one?
Yeah, I mean, usually there's this very uncomfortable place in every year where I'm on the road promoting one book, editing another book, and then writing the one that's behind.
Oh my gosh.
Behind. So that's a very schizophrenic. And then obviously, you know, trying to like raise a daughter and live a life and do all that other stuff. So there's usually like one space in the year that's like, I just actually emerged from that space.
Oh wow.
So I'm feeling a little bit more sane than I felt over the last few months. But yeah, so it's kind of an ongoing, process, but you know, I mean, for me, it's, you know, I never wanted to do anything else. You know, I'm grateful that I'm able to, you know, do what I love to do and that, you know, I get to kind of dwell in this world building, dream weaving state that, you know, that I get to dwell in a lot. So it's never really, you know, it's never really, there's never a moment where I'm, you know, unhappy.
Just sometimes really, that, really busy.
Just sometimes you're really, really busy. Like sometimes not getting enough sleep. Sometimes like waking up at 3 a.m. and going, oh, that's it. You know, like those kind of, you know, wake up. So, well, yeah. So it's
Lisa,
okay.
How did you get your first book published?
Well, okay. So it's never a short story, right? So not very often. I had, you know, as I mentioned, been writing for, you know, forever since I was a kid. And, you know, but I never really thought like it was something I could, you know, do for a living. And mainly that's because my father told me that it wasn't. My dad was an engineer and he was like, look, it's great that you can string a few coherent sentences together, but this is not a job. Like people don't ever make a living doing this. It was like,
wrong he was.
Yeah. So I was like, well, you know, I've got you covered for college. I'm going to send you to college. Right. And while you're there, you can take basket weaving for all I care. But once you graduate, you're like off the payroll, like, you know, don't move home kind of a thing. I was like, okay. So, you know, after I graduated, even though I started my first novel when I was 19 years old, I started it when I was still in college. I didn't have, like, the confidence when I graduated to really pursue that, and I also needed to get a job. So I went into publishing, and I worked in publishing for almost 10 years. So unfortunately, I happened to be extremely good at my job. I was a book publicist, and, you know, so basically, like, putting authors in the media and throwing parties and traveling with authors and all of that stuff. And I did that, and you know, my job just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger until I got to a place in my life where I wasn't writing at all. And I had like an epiphany. There was like this moment in my life where I realized like everything about my life was wrong. It was with the wrong guy. I was devoting 110% of myself to a job that I didn't love, and that the only thing I ever wanted to do was just laying fallow. And I figured, you know, 5 years, 10 years down the road, I was going to have to look back at myself and go, you know what? You never even tried to do it. And I just couldn't live with that. You know, I figured I could live with failure, but I wasn't going to be able to live with, you know, just a slow fade to nothing. So I got really serious about my writing at that point. And I started writing every day. I mean, which is really the only thing you need to do, right? Mm-hmm. To be a writer. You don't need to talk about writing. You don't need to think about writing. You just need to sit down and write.
Yeah.
And so I started doing that every day. And if that meant I was writing on the train on my way into work, or if I was staying in, or I was, you know, getting up super early in the morning to work, that's what I did. And it took me about a year from that point to finish my first novel. Because that's the most important thing, right? You have to finish the book.
Right.
You got to do that. If you want to get published, you have to finish your novel. So I did that. And then I was like kind of unsure even so what to do. Because, you know, even though I was in publishing, I was kind of on the other end of it, you know, and I didn't really, and I was still scared, you know, like I was happy that I finished the book, you know, like, because that's a big deal, because a lot of people never even do that. And I was like, okay, I finished the book that I started when I was 19 years old. I was 29 years old at the time. So it took me 10 years on and off to finish my first novel. And then, you know, I went to Florida, and while I was at Sloppy Joe's in Key West, I met my husband.
Oh.
Yeah. And so it was this complete, like, sort of love at first sight moment. And he was living in Detroit at the time. I was in New York City. Within 6 months, he had proposed. We had both quit our big corporate jobs. I sold my apartment that I owned in Brooklyn Heights. And I said, I'm giving myself 1 year to sell the book that I wrote and to write another one.
And where were you living at that point?
We moved to Florida.
Okay.
We moved to Clearwater, Florida, wherever he got the best job. Okay. And I was still doing my freelance public relations writing and stuff. So I still had a job because I'm my father's daughter. I'm not gonna move without, you know, still having a way to earn a living. But I also had, like, sort of my money from the apartment that I sold. And I was like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. And so I did. I sent, when I left New York, I sent my book to my 5 top choice agents. And I was signed on by Elaine Markson, who just last year, this year just passed away. I sold my book to her, and she, or I, you know, I sent my book to her, and she sold it to St. Martin's Press for a 2-book deal, the one that I had written and the one that I was writing. And it was like basically like, you know, a nickel and a cheese sandwich. I think that was my advance. it was like I don't quit your day job kind of advance, even though I had already
quit your day job.
Yeah. But it didn't matter, because that was like a dream come true, you know, like I mean, that was like, you know, a big moment, you know, and I knew that, you know, I think is being, so all my years in publishing and working at Penguin Putnam, it didn't help me actually get published, unfortunately, but it did help me understand the business and to know that, you know, a lot of writers think of that publishing contract as a windfall, you know, like it's like that big moment. It's like the end of something. I'm published. But I knew it was just an open door to the writing life.
Right.
And that, you know, you walk through, and it's harder to succeed as a published writer than it is to get published in the first place. And it's damn hard to get published in the first place. And so I knew I had to roll my sleeves up and get to work. If I wanted to succeed. And that's what I did. And so I think that was like sort of my big advantage of coming from publishing into, you know, sort of the writing life, is that I knew the business and I knew that, you know, that it's better to start, you know, at the bottom and work your way up.
Lisa, do you think that a lot of people in the publishing industry want to be writers?
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that's true of, I'm sure that's true of some people. At the time when I was writing, I didn't know that many people who had a burning desire to write. I myself kept my sort of, you know, writing aspirations secret because it just seems so, it's so embarrassing. You know what I mean? It's like being a waitress and like in LA and really wanting to act. It's like, oh yeah, sure. You know? And, I kind of kept my thing secret, and I know that most people who are editors, you know, have a real passion for editing. Like they have a real passion for that author-editor relationship where, you know, you help someone who is a writer sort of take their book to the next level, or, you know, help them be the best. And so there's a real passion to editorial work. I don't know if everybody who gets into publishing is secretly a writer. I'm sure there's more than a few.
Yeah, well, that would be one reason writers, readers are drawn to that industry.
Right, because readers are equally passionate. Like, not all readers are writers.
Right.
You know, some people are just passionate about literature and books.
Yeah.
So, you know, and some people are passionate about the business of publishing. So, I mean, surely some people, you know, go to that because they love, you know, they love the industry and they love
books.
Yeah.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Lisa Unger, author of Under My Skin, which is her 16th novel. Lisa, why don't you read a little bit from the prologue of Under My Skin?
Yes, I'm happy to do that. I like him. I do. But there's always a but, isn't there? He's talking, and I should be listening. I'm not. Does he see it when I'm scattered, distracted? It's doubtful. He doesn't seem especially observant, has that way about him that people do now, as if they are putting on a show of themselves, as if the moment is being watched rather than lived. He glances about as he talks, up at the television screen, over the bar, all on mute, all tuned in to different sporting events. Down at the phone that sits dark beside him, back to me, off again to the rowdy table across from us, post-work gathering, I'm guessing, from the rumpled suits and tired eyes. I soak in the details of him. His shock of ink-black hair, thick, any girl would kill for it. Dark stubble on his jaw, just enough. Sexy, not unkempt. Style, not neglect. His gym-toned body. Beneath the folds of his lavender Oxford, the dip of cut abs. The round of a well-worked shoulder. If I had a camera in my hand, not a smartphone, but a real camera, say a mirrorless Hasselblad 10-1D, ergonomic light, old-school style with high-tech innards. I'd watch him through the lens and try to find the moment when he revealed himself, when the muscles in his face relaxed and the mask dropped, even just for a millisecond. Then I'd see him, the man he really is when he steps off the stage he imagines himself on. I already knew he was handsome, stylish, in shape, before we agreed to meet. His profile told me as much. He works in finance. Of course he does. His favorite book is the Steve Jobs autobiography. What else? But what's under his skin, that carefully manicured outer layer? Beneath the mask he puts on in the morning, what's there? The camera always sees it. He runs his fingertips along the varnished edge of the table between us, then steeples them. I read somewhere that this is a gesture of someone very sure of himself and his opinions. It tracks. He seems very sure of himself, as people who know very little often are. He laughs, so self-deprecating at something he's just said about himself. His words still hang in the air, something about his being a workaholic. What a relief that it's just drinks, not dinner. No point in wasting time if it's not there, he wrote. Who could disagree? So adult, so reasonable. I never thought it would be. It can't be. Because it has nothing to do with the way he looks. It isn't about his eyes, black, heavily lashed, and half-lidded, or the bow of his mouth, full, kissable. Well, I might kiss him anyway. Maybe more. Depends. Attraction, desire is nothing to do with the physical. It's chemical. A head trip. In my head, well, let's just say, it's not on straight. A woman laughs too loud, a cackle really harsh and jarring. It startles me, sends a pulse of adrenaline through me. I scan the crowd. I really shouldn't be here. Time for another, he asks. His teeth, they're so white, perfectly aligned. Nothing in nature is so flawless. Braces, whitening. The rim of the glass is ice cold beneath my fingertip. The drink went down fast, too fast. I promised myself I wouldn't drink, not with everything that's been going on. It's been a long day, a long week, a long year. The weight of it all is tugging at me, pulling me under. I take too long to answer, and he frowns, just slightly, looks at his phone. I should just leave. This is crazy. Sure, I say instead. One more. He smiles again, thinks it's a good sign. Really, I just want to go home, pull up my hair, put on my sweats, get into bed. Even that's not an option. Once we walk out of here, it's back to the jigsaw puzzle of my life. Grey Goose and soda, he tells the waitress when he's flagged her down. He remembers what I'm drinking. A small thing, but so few people pay attention to the details these days. And Blanton's on the rocks. Straight bourbon. Very manly. Am I talking too much? He says. He looks sweetly sheepish. Is it put on? I've heard that before. My last girlfriend, Kim, she said I ramble when I get nervous. It's the second time he's mentioned her. His last girlfriend, Kim. Why, I wonder, carrying a torch, or just trying to market himself as someone who's been in a relationship? Also, last girlfriend, it begs the question, how many others? Maybe I'm reading too much into it. I do that. Not at all. I am a seeker. I want to explore the world, don't you? I love to learn, to cook, to travel. I get lost in a good book. That's what his profile said. In his picture, he smiled, nearly laughing, hair wind-tossed. It was a good photo. It could have come from a magazine, which is always suspicious. Photographers know all the tricks to capturing beauty. The right angles, the proper lighting, the magic of filters. The truth is that most people aren't that hot in person. Even beautiful people, real ones, are flawed in some way. Not airbrushed or prettily windblown. Eyes glittering. Lines around the eyes and mouth. An almost imperceptibly crooked nose. A faint scar. Chicken pox or a childhood fall from a bike. People, real people, have a little stain from lunch on their ties, maybe something hanging from their nose or in their teeth, patches of dry skin, shoes that need replacing. These imperfections make us who we are, tell the truth of our lives. But to his credit, he is as close to good-looking as his profile picture. But something's off. What is it? I think that's 6 minutes.
And that is Lisa Unger reading from her latest novel, Under My Skin. Now, I noticed when I was reading the book that there was a lot of sort of moving around in terms of time and flashbacks and so forth. And when you're writing, how do you write like from beginning to end, or you know, how do you decide how to structure the book chronologically?
That's a good question. I don't know if I have a good answer. because of the way I write, you know, I almost, you know, I sort of follow the way the story comes to me through the character, if that makes any sense. So I don't have any, you know, technique for switching back between time frames, and I tend to do this a lot. I often have multiple timelines in my story, and the way I always think of it is, you know, there are very few of us that are actually living in the present tense. You know, we're all sort of an amalgamation of, you know, our past experiences, you know, our thoughts and worries about the future, and, you know, often in our sort of life, our linear life, as we're moving through our life, you know, we're dwelling on the past and, you know, projecting ourselves into an imagined future. So that's kind of how we structure our lives anyway. And so that's sort of how the books kind of unfold for me. So, you know, as I'm writing, if I happen to be in the, you know, in the present moment, you know, when I am sort of called to go back in order to build character or, you know, build a scaffolding for the present day narrative, I tend just to shift back into the past. And obviously in this case with Poppy being, you know, kind of an unreliable narrator, I was sort of beholden to how, you know, she was remembering and dreaming and all of that. So I just kind of followed that. So obviously this is all first draft stuff, right? I mean, when you write that way, you know, I tend to honor the narrative as it comes to me. But then when you're in the editorial phase, I always think of the first draft as, you know, it's the best that I can do. Like by the time I turn it in to my editor, I've been through it like sort of three or four times. I've done a first draft, they've done a second, a third, and a fourth draft, you know, so I've gone back, I've read, I've, you know, seen like, okay, I need to link these two sections better, or this is not working or whatever. So I've gone through multiple drafts, and then, you know, once my editor has done, you know, sort of her work of content editing, there was like this big conversation. So that's where I kind of, you know, figure out whether or not I'm making things clear enough for the reader, and like all of the kind of work of, you know, bringing the book out into the world. So, you know, it's kind of like the second layer of the creative process. So anything that's not working in terms of timeline, or if it's too confusing or too jumping back and forth, and hopefully any of those narrative problems will get fixed in the editorial phase.
That's the thing about this suspense writing or thriller writing, is it's, you know, you have so many layers of competency that you have to bring to the writing process. You know, there's the ability to tell, well, the first there is the ability to imagine a story that has a plot that is interesting,
right,
has a satisfying end. Then there's the ability to, you know, the use of words and language to paint the picture of the characters and the scenery and so forth. But then there's knowing how much and when to divulge information to keep the reader interested but not confused. And
right.
I would think that's the hardest part.
Yeah, and for me, you know, just because of the way I'm writing, like, I actually don't know what's going to happen. So, I think that contributes to the, you know, sort of immediacy of the work, is because I'm, like, very invested in what's happening, because I don't, you know, I'm, like I said, I'm sort of in a way, I'm writing for the same reason that I read. The other sort of way that I tend to think about it is like the story's there and I'm just trying to find it. So I'm basically like kind of uncovering it as I go. So, you know, I tend to, and when I'm done with that first draft, you know, like I would say 95% of it is usually there structurally. You know, so it's not like a lot of big pieces get moved after the first draft gets laid down, not for me. But, you know, and also, you know, I'm able, because I've been doing this for like such a long time, like since I was a kid, like I kind of know that as I'm writing, even if I don't understand why a character has done something or why something has happened, you know, or some, you know, some object is there or whatever it happens to be, like I know myself well enough to know to just leave it and know that at some point further down in the narrative, I'm going to go, oh,
that's why.
So it's almost like my subconscious knows the story better than I do, which is such a weird thing to say, but, you know, it's just kind of the way it is.
Mom, were you surprised at the ending of this story?
Yes, I was. Well, actually, well, I know, well, I don't want to be a spoiler, so I'm not going to say what I thought.
Yeah.
I had some suspicion early on. Yeah. And what I'm wondering is, when you get to the end of the story and you know who did it, who the guilty party is, as you're writing, do you then sometimes have to go back and drop in a few more hints earlier on? or maybe change a few things that may have led
or the opposite, like, you know, oh, it was telegraphed too early or whatever. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, tweaks and things that get done in the editorial phase, because, you know, you do want to delay that release of information as much as possible, and it can't just be like, you know, it can't come from nowhere. But you also want to make sure that intensity for the reader is present.
Right. Well, I think the best stories have multiple potentially guilty parties where when you get to the end, it could say, oh yeah, that makes sense.
Right.
And not mm-hmm. just one, but it's very, it's not fun to read something that you get to the end and there's such a surprise ending that it was never, and there weren't any clues and it seems contrived.
Right. Right.
So you never want that.
And for me, you know, it's all like, you know, the plot all flows from character. You know, all my novels are really character driven. And for me, that's the deepest curiosity for me, is the curiosity of character, is getting to know the individual people and what makes them who they are. So that's always going to be the driving force for me and for all of the stories. It's not just about who did it or what happened. That's part of it, but it's more for me about the people in the book. And I think that, you know, that's true of any book that, you know, we really connect with. You know, character is king. And, you know, you could have constructed the most perfect plot, but if people don't, you know, care about your characters, then the story doesn't matter as much.
That's definitely true.
Yeah.
You know, in this book, you have some of your characters are photographers, and you have many references to the art of photography and its relevance to the modern world. And, you know, I never thought about that before, but it's really, and now that everybody has a camera at hand, you know, it's really.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really interesting thing. I mean, it's definitely something that, you know, is notable to me as an observer and also as someone who has a smartphone that I, you know, sort of reluctantly have. You know, I'm like sort of annoyed by its presence in my life and like my reliance on it. So I really limit the amount of time I spend on it. You know, like I keep it, you know, like I don't have any social media on it and I don't answer my email from it and like all this stuff, or try not to. And I try to make sure it's, you know, in my bag when I'm in the car, so I'm not tempted to look at it when I'm driving, you know, like all this different stuff. But what I notice is that most people are not even aware that 90% of the time they're staring at their phone.
Yeah.
And like if you're in an airport or, you know, out on a city street or anywhere where there's a tremendous collection of people or even a restaurant, if you look around the room, you will notice that about 90% of people are staring at their phone like a large majority of the time.
Oh, yeah.
And they have completely stopped seeing everything else around them.
Yeah.
Unless they're using that phone to take a photograph. And then they're using that phone to take a picture. And they're not taking a picture because they are like gonna, you know, keep it as like a diary or, you know, have it for some future use. They're taking it because they're gonna post it on social media. And so they're basically curating this in this really interesting way. They're curating the experience of their lives for consumption,
mm-hmm.
by other people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really fascinating. I haven't quite gotten to the, I mean, it's definitely not good. Like, let's just be clear. Like, this is not a positive thing. This is a scary thing. I'm still trying to figure out, like, what it's going to mean down the road.
I know.
But I mean, I think a lot of people are experiencing their lives through their, you know, curated photo images. And if you think about, like, I mean, think about your own childhood. Like, how many pictures are there of you from your childhood? Like, 10, maybe 20? Right? Like, I mean, I have a small album that my mom made for me of all, pretty much all our pictures. And there aren't that many pictures. And yet my daughter's life, you know,
thousands.
Is like there's barely a second that has been undocumented.
Yeah.
In her life. I mean, there's literally every moment of her life has been photographed. Or videoed or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's just curious because, you know, you think about, like, you know, my husband's parents passed away early and we don't have that many pictures of them. Mm. We have very few. And you kind of lament that. But then you think to yourself, what of these, you know, if I've been married to my husband for 18 years, you know, my daughter will turn 13 on Christmas Day. The amount of digitally stored photos that we have is, like, epic.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of photos. Like, what's going to happen to those photos? Like, you know, if you follow it at, like, is my daughter going to want all those photos? Are her children going to want those photos? Like, you know, is anybody going to want to see all of that? And, like, and then multiplied by, you know, billions of people in the world.
Right. Like, Plus, the other thing is when we took photos on film and we had them printed out, and of course some of them were terrible, but you got the photos back and you wrote on the back of them but you often wrote on the back of them something about what it was. Now, and the digital photos are, well, at least they're date stamped, so you have that.
Mm-hmm.
But unless you've posted them on social media with a comment. You don't have, there's most, very few people, let's say, have annotated those photos. So what are they going to mean 100 years from now?
Yeah. And it's just, you know, I think it, like, as myself, like, sort of a semi-minimalist and, like, you know, we really purge and clutter clear. And I look at all these photos and I'm like, well, isn't, you know, this digital storage, isn't this like just another form of clutter?
What
do we do with all these photos? I mean, what do we do with all these photos? I mean, it's just kind of an interesting.
It is.
An interesting
and,
idea.
Yeah.
And like, how is it changing our perception?
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, a whole other subject we could spend another hour on.
A whole other novel.
Yeah. But we are out of time.
Get busy.
All right, I'm on it.
We're out of time right now. So, Mom, do you have some closing words for us?
Yeah, I do, actually. The only way you can truly repay those who help you is by helping others.
Wonderful. And Lisa, thanks so much for being with us today. And if you want to our listeners, if you want a good thriller to keep you up at night, go get Under My Skin.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been really fun.
And see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Bye-bye.